This is Interviews with Technical People with John Robertson
and James Haview,
a podcast where we interview technical people in STEM fields
to discuss the past, present, and future from their perspective.
And the one announcement I want to make is happy Thanksgiving and happy Black Friday. We expect to release this episode on Black Friday, so I hope you all are having a wonderful holiday. And today we are joined by Dr. Aaron Funk. Aaron grew up in West Virginia and received his PhD in chemistry from Florida Tech in 2013, and since then has worked at a variety of small companies. He's taught chemistry and was an associate project scientist at UCLA, and for the last 3 years has worked in commercial science and sales in analytical chemistry at Anton Parr. Dr. Funk, Aaron, welcome to the show.
What's up?
We are thrilled to have you because...
happy to be here.
As the listeners will know, we have not really delved into chemistry too much. We've talked a lot about space. We recently had a veterinarian on the show, but it's time to get back to our hard science roots. So, Aaron, you've done a lot of things over the course of your relatively short career, but can you tell us in your own words, what is it that you do and perhaps have done since you've done so much?
Well, what I do right now is... Can I swear on this podcast?
I prefer you not, because okay. I don't want to have to do the content.
Sure. Click. No, that's good to know.
If you could try not to.
Oh no, that's great. I think that's I'll go G-rated. So I sell stuff. I sell stuff right now, basically to various different industries. Those industries would be kind of all over the place. One of our main clients is cannabis industry, so cannabis testing labs, huge field. A lot of labs that are doing different types of analysis. Heavy metals analysis is kind of the main thing that I deal with because I sell microwave digestion, which is used for sample prep for ICP-MS, which is used to identify stuff. So let's say the best way to break this down, let's say you've got a pharmaceutical, right? Some kind of, you know, Adderall, right? So Adderall, for example, would need to be tested and made sure it doesn't have heavy metals in it or whatever elements you're looking at. But heavy metals is a common one that you need to make sure is not there. So
this is for like health and safety purposes.
Yes. Right. Yeah. For ingestion or, I mean, this is going to be done with cannabis products. This is going to be done with consumer products. This is going to be done with anything.
Are these usually tested by the people producing the substances?
Sometimes. And sometimes they ship it out to a third party lab. So we would sell to the people producing the substance. We would sell to production if they test in-house, or we would sell to a third-party lab if they ship it out. Now, it honestly depends on how large the company is. So a large company can afford to test in-house. Smaller ones may not be able to because those instruments are expensive. So let's say you've got, we'll say a pharmaceutical, for example, an Adderall, right? So you're looking at most likely heavy metals, mercury, cadmium, arsenic, and lead. And in order to determine whether or not those are in a particular sample, whatever that sample might be, you have to break down that sample. So everything is made up of chemical bonds. And in order to understand how much lead is in something, you must break the bond that the lead is bound to, right? And to do that, the most common way of doing that is an acid digestion, where you essentially take the sample, add acid to it, tighten it up, and heat the poop out of it. And then you can take that, dilute that mixture. And at that point, you're really just left with free floating elements. And then you're going to inject that onto an ICP-MS, which stands for inductively coupled plasma mass spectrometry for what it's worth, but maybe nobody cares.
Which is what you sell, right?
I sell the sample prep. I do not sell ICP-MS.
Okay. Good to make that clear.
But they work together.
Got it.
And you kind of need, you know, if somebody has an ICP-MS, then they need the microwave digestion. So that's one thing that I sell. The other main thing I sell would be a microwave synthesis instrument. So I had a pretty big sale last year to a large pharmaceutical company in the Bay Area. So that's another thing that's going to be common is you're going to sell those synthesis instruments. Now, those are mostly going to go to pharmaceutical for, let's say, you're doing some kind of, you know, you need to run thousands of reactions because you're trying all different types of things because you're trying to, you know, drug design. So you would do that. Or you might have that in a chemistry lab in a university that is doing that instead of other things, because for microwave synthesis, for example, if you reach back into your brains to Arrhenius's law, which tells you that you need to, as you increase, you know, pressure, you or increase the temperature and increase the pressure of something, you can increase the reaction rate, right? So instead of something taking 2 hours, you know, if it's pressurized and you heat it up without, you know, obviously disintegrate or decomposing the sample, then you can decrease the reaction time and save a lot of time. So that's another way, another reason why microwaves are helpful. And then also I do sell the Raman spectrometers as well.
Okay. I have
which are all over the place.
In fact, I love that you said, even just hearing the word Raman spectrometer takes me right back to grad school, because I spent a lot of time in a dark room doing Raman spectroscopy. And I would wager many people in the audience have no idea what Raman spectroscopy is, but
I don't.
It's delicious.
I don't know if they need to know what it is, but the very first question that I have, and because you said a lot and I'm like digesting it as we go.
No pun intended.
I actually want to go way back to one of the first things that you said. So put ourselves in the shoes of, say, a pharmaceutical company who they need to scan for, say, mercury or lead. How do I say this? Does lead and mercury just show up in pharmaceuticals? Like, that seems odd to me that they would need to filter that out. Maybe it's just a requirement, but like, why is there mercury getting into medicines just out of...
Or is it something that shows up commonly? Like,
yeah.
So it really depends on what your precursors are, and it depends on what is being used in synthesis. So now in cannabis, for example, those are going to show up more often just because its soil is very dirty.
Oh.
And you're going to find all different types of crap in soil, right? So as you just need to make sure it's obviously below a certain level. Because soil is, I mean, it's the ground, right? It's like the dirtiest stuff we have next to like ocean water or something like that. But it's, you know, there's all different types of stuff in there. So if you're a pharmaceutical company and let's say you're making something, now that maybe they don't necessarily have to test for that, right? For mercury or lead. But let's say somewhere earlier in the synthesis process, they used lead nitrate or whatever, right?
Mm,
or lead chloride or anything like that somewhere down or upstream, somewhere upstream in the synthesis process, then you would have to test for that later to prove that it's not there. Now, granted, if it was never there to begin with and it isn't in any of your starting material and it doesn't show up, and so, I mean, you might find that, let's say you're synthesizing with a methane or not methane, but let's say you're synthesizing with dichloromethane or something like that, right? As a solvent. And you look on the jar on the thing and it's like in the PPM level, there's some whatever in there, right? Because these things kind of carry through whatever process they started with. So you do have to prove somewhere down the line that it's no longer there, or at least under a certain level that is not dangerous to human consumption or the environment or both.
Are those usually government set levels, or do companies try to do better than even government set levels?
Companies are going to try to do the least they can do. So they're going to definitely just go bare minimum, whatever the government says, you have to do this. So these are mostly government regulations, at least from what I understand.
Yeah.
So, okay, the other question that came to mind. So this is actually cool. I'm trying to think big picture here. So you sell both these devices that are able to detect certain substances or elements within the pharmaceuticals, but you also said you sell the actual synthesizers.
Correct.
Now, that's curious to me, because when I think of like the bare basics of what is required for a chemical reaction, like what I think of is mixing two chemicals and then sometimes applying heat.
Correct.
Is that what a synthesizer is, or is there like what is the complexity beyond just doing it in, say, a test tube?
So, well, if you're looking at a microwave synthesis instrument, microwaves are easier to control than just conventional heating. So it's going to give you a more precise temperature control. And that's going to be sort of your main thing. And it's also going to give you a pressurized system, which again, considering Arrhenius' law, you're going to have essentially what you're going to do with the synthesis instrument itself. The idea of having it pressurized, again, is going to allow you to have a smaller or a shorter reaction time. Something that might take 2 hours may now take 5 minutes because of the way that the chemistry works out when you pressurize something.
Okay. I have another question.
All day. I'm happy.
I don't want to throw you curveballs.
Hey, if I don't know, I am more than happy to tell you I don't know, because the only thing that I am certain about is that I am uncertain about everything.
Can you explain to me from a fundamental level how microwaves heat up stuff? I'm a physicist and I think I know, but I'm not really sure. So if you don't know, I understand.
Well, as you'll know, chemistry stops and physics begins, right? So that's the intersection, right? There's not a lot of overlap, at least in my mind, right? Because I don't know Richard about physics. So can we say that? I could say that, right? That's fine.
Sure.
So I like I'm pushing the edge of what I can and can't say.
The only person who has so far.
You've seen Ghostbusters?
Of course.
Okay, so when Peter first goes to Dana's apartment, you know, he's talking or whatever, and she says, you know, you don't seem like a scientist. You're more like a game show host. That's always remind me of myself. Whatever, I'm just here for a good time. So, to your question, I'm not really sure, but sort of fundamentally, and this is going to sound like a lazy answer, but the microwaves, from what I understand, are generated by a magnetron, which is some kind of magnetic something that is generating microwaves.
I think I was wondering more about how the heat is generated on whatever is receiving the microwaves.
Okay. No, that's a good question.
Was it some sort of resonance in the water molecule or something?
Something about how it flips at the resonant frequency of like the rotation of the molecule. Anyway, you sound like that flipped.
That's a really good question. So what is being heated by the microwaves is generally water, and that works because of polarity. Now, interestingly, in our instrumentation, we have in our microwave synthesis reactor, we have silicon carbide vessels that you can buy if you're using a nonpolar solvent such as hexane. Because hexane is not going to be heated by microwaves because it's nonpolar, or at least not well at all. When you have something that's microwave invisible or doesn't heat very well with microwaves, then you can heat it in something else. So that's why like we have those silicon carbide vessels that you can get. And then those are going to absorb microwaves. And then you can heat something that way if you're using something that is nonpolar.
So the silicon carbide will heat up in the presence of microwaves and warm up something like hexane that is nonpolar.
That is correct, yes.
Okay.
Okay. I'm thinking out loud. When you put metals in the microwave, weird stuff happens.
Yes.
My physics mind wants to tell me that's not because necessarily they're nonpolar, but because there's an electron cloud that can still oscillate with the microwave. Is that your understanding?
Yes. Yeah, like, so essentially, we're not going to be putting any metal in the microwave, at least not in the presence, not just sitting there by itself, right? You can digest metal in the microwave. But,
so not a microwave that expensive.
Sure, yeah. Now, you can obviously digest metal, but it has to be in acid and in a small enough quantity that the nitric acid can react with it.
Digest meaning in the synthesizer?
Okay, so keep these two things separate. We sell synthesizer, which makes stuff, and the digester, which destroys stuff. That's kind of the easiest way to think about it.
Are they both microwaves?
They are using microwave energy, yes.
Okay.
Fascinating.
Yes. So we can destroy. We can, I don't like to use the word create, but we can make, right? We can destroy, we can make, and we, because we're not really creating anything because it's already here, right? Like I'm making, if I make two things, like I'm not, like if I mix together stuff. Sure. Yeah. Like I'm not creating cookies. If I bake cookies, I'm not creating a cookie out of nothing. Right. Cause I remember Andy used to say that he's like, we don't create here. We're not creating. Andy's my PhD advisor, but yeah, he would always say we don't create stuff. So anyway, we synthesize, right. And we destroy, and then we can also analyze with the ramen.
Something you glossed over, but I'm going to ask about it again. Since you work with microwaves a lot, and you say a microwave is essentially a big magnetron.
What it's like, not necessarily, it's that's the heating element is the magnetron.
Okay. I was wondering if you could, what is a microwave? The hardware involved in creating microwaves.
So I guess the hardware involved is pretty well, obviously a bunch of housings and whatever else is in there, but right. The heating element itself is a magnetron.
What is a magnetron? I guess the question. I mean,
you tell me.
I don't know.
I'm not sure if I can describe a magnetron. I probably should, since I sell them.
I say that's.
But no one ever. I mean, it's a question no one will ever ask, right? Unless I'm on your podcast, and then you'll ask.
But we're talking with technical people.
Exactly.
So let me add something to this conversation. Back in the day, I used to be a proficient user. I was almost a super user of a magnetron sputterer, if you're familiar with what that is.
Oh, I'm
so,
most definitely not familiar with that. What is that?
So a magnetron sputterer is a really neat tool that's often used to deposit thin films. And so the essential working mechanism is you start with a precursor piece of material, right? Say like a puck of raw aluminum, and you create a plasma in the chamber, and then that plasma is able to etch the surface of, say, the aluminum puck, which then releases the aluminum atoms, and then they can redeposit on whatever your target sample is. So the magnetron sputterer presumably also uses a magnetron. I feel like we have some homework to actually look into what a magnetron is. I can tell you that it was used to make that oscillating plasma of whatever known frequency user input. So I still don't know exactly the physical principle of how it works, but I can tell you it creates oscillating waves.
All right. So how's this? Magnetron's job is to generate fairly short radio waves. Well, not radio waves, but obviously microwaves. So the magnetron is a high-powered vacuum tube that works as a self-excited microwave oscillator. Or so I am told on radartutorial.eu.
Sounds legit.
Yeah, I mean, it says crossed electron and magnetic fields are used in the magnetron to produce the high power output required in radar equipment. But whatever. So using some kind of oscillating vacuum tube, something, I don't know.
I want to ask another question before we turn this into an episode completely on microwaves, which was not the intent. But I want to just generally ask you, because again, I don't like encounter that many chemists in the wild. Can you explain to me like how a chemist might think about a problem differently from, say, a physicist or anyone else, or even like a chemical engineer? What is the way chemists approach problems typically?
That's a really good question. And I'm not sure if I approach problems because I am a chemist or because of how, like what I observed from my dad, or because of the PhD process. So I think I'm probably more shaped by my dad was a field service engineer for IBM for a long time. He's been retired for a while now, my dad can make, fix like anything. It is insane. He's 63, right? And he, like, even a couple years ago, he built a large garage, but pretty much by himself, him and my mother. So like the only thing he didn't do was lay the concrete and roof it. But there were these big truss things, trying to explain them, like roof pieces. And he made these like this steps So he would go to one side, pick it up, go to the other side, pick it up, and carry it up the thing by himself. Like, you know, you wonder how people built the pyramids. Like, I think my dad probably could have built the pyramids. And he uses, like, he knows he's not strong enough to do certain things. So he, like, builds pulleys and things like that. Who builds a pulley? Like, he makes he uses pulleys for things. It's crazy. So, I mean, and he can fix anything, and it's wild. So, and he also, like, now that he, now that YouTube is the thing, like, he sent us some video the other day. He's restoring two old cars. One he's pretty much done with. The other one he kind of just started on. And he sent us a video the other day of him, like, intricately sewing upholstery. And I was like, how did you know how to do this? So
wait, he's also a YouTuber making these videos?
No, he doesn't make the videos. He watches them.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no, so, I wish he was a YouTuber. That would be amazing.
We could make this happen.
I know. So I think what I learned from my dad is that there is no unsolvable problem. Like, you'll figure it out. Like, look it up, figure it out how to do it. Like, I've never heard
a solution.
Exactly. I've never heard him be like, well, I can't do that, or I don't know how to do that. Like, he would never, like, the idea that he would say, I don't know how to do that, and just give up there makes no sense to me. This is not a thing. So I think that's one aspect of it. And another aspect of it is going through the PhD process and really being completely challenged on everything, and everything sort of what you think about things is completely broken down. And by saying, like, oh, okay, well, you know, why? And just being asked why about 1,000 times. I remember rehearsing for my dissertation defense with my advisor, and I had to say something, he would say why. And I say something else, he'd say why. And then it's like, oh, this is obviously this annoying, but, you know, you're still learning to think about things very, you know, theoretic or very, very thoughtful, right? So I try not to approach human behavior this way as much, because people don't love that. So, you know, I pretty much, like, my wife doesn't love it all the time, but sometimes, like, she'll use the same tactics against me, and I'm like, well, what are you doing? She's like, I learned this from you. Okay. So I think it's a combination of those two things. But in terms of a chemist, I would say really just thinking critically about what is going on, what can I test?
Interesting.
Multifaceted response.
That is so multifaceted. I thought you were going to say something about, like, chemical bonding or something, but you didn't even mention that word.
Yeah. No.
Think critically. No,
it's just how you think, yeah.
Interesting. Well, we got some of your backstory, so why don't we just keep going on this tangent? You want to tell us a little bit about the path to how you got to where you are? I guess you already started with your dad. What did your road look like?
That's a great question. So I grew up in West Virginia, and I probably went to probably one of the worst high schools in the country in terms of quality of education.
Okay, so, like, not your opinion, just an actual fact. It was,
I mean, not a great high school. Yeah, fact-based trash. Okay. Nothing against the people that were there, right? They were doing what they could with what they had and the money they had, right? So, you know, what are you going to do, right? You're in the coal fields of West Virginia, depressed area, where drugs started to really become a problem around that time. And now it's, like, a horrible problem. And West Virginia is a fascinating state. I mean, West Virginia, which I always have to tell people, like, is not Virginia, different states. It was part of Virginia, but they separated June 20th, 1863. It's been a while.
Oh, man. It's
been a while, right? Yes. So West Virginia is just as different from Virginia as Utah is different from Nebraska, right? So they're very different, right? They're so different that they're different states. Anyway, I can soapbox West Virginia all day. But I grew up sort of with not a lot of direction in school by any means, right? I had supportive parents, which was helpful, right? But no direction in a scholastic way or an academic way.
So by that, do you mean, like, there was no, a lot of people just say you got to go to college because it's the thing to do, right? Like, it's almost not even an option. So even, like, that level wasn't really there for you?
No, I mean, from my parents, sure, but not so much from the school. Like, I graduated with, I think, 160 people from high school, and I'd say 15 of them graduated from college, maybe.
Yeah, that's fair. That's below average.
It's very low. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So real quick, like, is coal mining still an active industry in West Virginia? Like, do they go and graduate high school and then do a like go to the coal mine like in October Sky?
It can be, yes, but if you look at you know, some people will point at certain things and say regulations, blah blah blah, this type of crap. But if you look at the actual data, coal mining in the United States has been on a relatively linear decline for the last 100 years. So it's just something that is declining. Like if you look at from 1920 to today, it's basically like, you know, just.
But I thought we were going to bring coal back and it was going to be beautiful, clean coal. What happened?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Wow, it's almost like that's not possible.
Oh, man.
I know. It makes me sad that the people of West Virginia were duped, but whatever. So it's a different story. So I think, at least for growing up in West Virginia, right? I went to high school. I remember in my 10th grade biology class. Biology class consisted of the teacher sitting in the front of the class. He would sometimes sit at his desk and fall asleep, or he would sometimes sit on the stool and he would play like a tape. I don't know what it was. I don't remember. Nobody does. And it didn't matter what you did. You got 100 on your test unless you cheated and then you got a B. But as long as you didn't cheat for like a few weeks, then you get hundreds again.
He fell asleep?
Yeah, he fell asleep a lot. He also dyed black hair. His name was Mr. Hager. He's probably not alive anymore. I doubt it. Everybody in West Virginia dies early. So, not everybody, obviously. I'm kidding. They don't, but some of them do, right? I don't know.
You're from West Virginia. Don't say that.
I mean, I'm from West Virginia, so I can say that. I love being from West Virginia.
I don't want you to die early.
No, I don't live there anymore, so I should be fine. And I exercise a lot. Fine. So I think I'm okay.
Okay, good.
It's usually poor diet, drugs, and no exercise. It's really what's going to get you kind of no matter where you live. It's just popular in West Virginia. So no direction there. And then I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to go to community college. So I lived at home for 2 years after high school and went to a community college and didn't really try at all. So I got in high school, I think I had like a 3.4 or something. And I didn't even come close to trying. Like I didn't care at all. And then in community college, I didn't care either, right? At all. Like I made a D in biology in community college, Southern West Virginia Community and Technical College, which is like the easiest stuff that's ever been, right? And then at that point, I transferred to West Virginia University. And I remember I got there and I had a teacher at community college and he taught psychology. And I had a death and dying class from him and I had a psychology class from him. And interestingly, his psychology class, I had first semester of college in community college. And that was on Tuesday nights. And I remember that because it was canceled on September 11th, 2001, because we did not have class that day.
Right.
So that's why I was not in that class that night. Now, great. It was a very interesting, you know, I really liked him. I thought he was cool. So I went to West Virginia University and I was like, I'm going to major in psychology because yeah, he's cool, right?
You do like to talk. It's not a terrible fit.
I know, right? So, except I can't really deal with hearing people's problems and then not fixing them. So that would be tough for me.
I get that.
Yeah. So, you know, I get to WVU and everything is so big and so overwhelming. And it's like, I hated it. Like I felt overwhelmed. I felt like I didn't know what I was doing. So I completely changed my major to pre-pharmacy. And frankly, I don't remember why. And during that semester, I had physics, chemistry, and biology. And I took biology and I realized, and then I took these classes and I realized I could get away with minimal studying and do pretty well in chemistry and physics and pretty awful in biology. So I dropped biology and I'm like, I guess I'm not doing pharmacy because biology sucks. So at that point, I was like, okay, I'm just going to do chemistry. And then I realized a Bachelor of Arts was my fastest way to graduate. And I finished the Bachelor of Arts, or I thought, well, I'll do the BS, and that took a little bit longer. And I thought about double majoring in chemistry and physics, and that was going to take longer too. And I was like, well, I don't know what the hell I'm doing anyway. I'm just do the short thing, right? And initially, I think I liked chemistry because it was challenging. So I finished that, and I was looking at going to optometry school. And I applied to 5 different places, didn't get into any of them. And I did pretty well on the optometry test in chemistry, in organic chemistry. Somehow I was like 62nd percentile in organic chemistry. And I promise you, I didn't know one question on the test. No idea. Not one. I have no idea how I got 62%. I guess I used chemical intuition, which is a word that I hate, but people use it sometimes. So I'll use it.
I was going to ask, you know, because I know what it's like to put in not a lot of effort, but still do pretty good on something. Like there's certain aspects of physics where I was like that, like in high school.
So yeah.
Did it just come naturally to you? Like how did that work?
I've always like just being around a problem solving brain. It probably didn't hurt. And I think, and this would, you know, if you have Enneagram listeners listening, right? I'm an Enneagram 3, and we are driven by success and appearing successful. So I think probably somewhere early on, I had sort of learned how to garner attention by being successful or smart or intelligent or whatever you want to call it, right? So I think that's maybe led me to that point. So I do that. I did pretty good on those and the test in those areas, and I scored 8th, like 7, 8, 9, like 8th percentile in reading. And I was like, whoa, why, what is wrong with me? Right. So I didn't get in because they're like, this dude can't even read. So then.
Okay. I had to process. So you're in, so by that you mean the bottom 8%, not the top 8%.
That means I did better at reading than 8% of the people that took the test.
Got it.
So not good. It's trash,
so
right?
So you can do chemistry, but you can't read about
it. Apparently I can't read at all. No. So and that was like, okay, because I never really read any books, right? Actually now, today, I do a book club with my mom, my brother, and my sister, which is cool. Granted, I'm actually behind right now. They're both finished with the book, and I've got like 100 pages. So I need to catch up. Anyway, that's a different story. So also kind of works with the fact that my reading score was so low. But when I finished, so I didn't get into those. And I was like, okay, well, I got a couple different ideas. One idea was that I said, well, maybe I'll move to Hollywood and try to be an actor. Because I really liked my acting class that I took at WVU. My other idea was to be an officer in the Navy, and the other one was to go to grad school in chemistry. And the only place I applied to was FIT. And
that's
I had
a good school.
It's crazy because like it was sort of out of my, you know, I had been to Melbourne once before because a girl I was dating at the time, her great uncle and grandmother lived there. And we had went down there once for a football game. Well, we went to Jacksonville for a football game and then stayed down there. And a couple of our other friends went. And I was like, hey, that's kind of cool. Like, maybe I'll apply there. And I applied there and then bugged the hell out of the lady, the admissions lady at the chemistry department. And then I found out I got in. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm going in this direction. And then I thought to myself, okay, maybe I'll just get a master's and go to med school or go to pharmacy school or something like that. And then I thought to myself, well, you know what? I think, like, and I thought about, okay, I know some people that are in pharmacy school and some people that are in med school. And it's like, I don't know if they're really, really challenged. So I was like, maybe I'll just get a PhD because it sounds hard. So that's what I did, like a crazy person.
I feel like you're admitting things that a lot of people have in their heart, but they don't want to say, right?
Hey, that's
like,
why I'm here today.
But it's so interesting. Like you ask someone why they're getting a PhD. They normally don't say because it's hard and it makes me look good.
Prestige is a huge reason for me. Absolutely.
But I think it is for everyone, but a lot of people won't say it, especially on a podcast.
I'm awesome. I don't give a poop.
You don't. but no, this is great. I think we're looking into the psyche I think is actually not that uncommon. Again, coming from grad school myself.
Yeah. It very well may be.
I just find it interesting. And, you know, John's got a PhD. I have partial completion of a master's degree, but I find it interesting that you went from not trying, not caring, like, to, I'll just get a PhD. Like, how hard could it be? Like, that seems like quite a shift, or just a mindset. I don't know. It's fascinating.
I'm nuts, I think. And I think one of the things that I noticed is, well, actually kind of my thought process through this is, yeah, I was just like, well, you know, let's see what happens. I mean, I don't know what else to do. No, I think the economy sucked at the time, right? It was like 2009. Yeah. Well, because I started it in 2007. It's like, well, there's no reason to hurry and get out of this and try and get a job in the recession.
Why not go to school?
So I was kind of like, well, I mean, I was already a couple years in, but I was kind of chilling. Yeah.
That's a good point. Why leave? The economy's crumbling. Just stay. Yeah.
And I was right, like, taking out tons of student loans and thinking that was free money.
Huh. Were you getting a master's or a PhD at the time?
I was only honestly in the master's program for a semester and then switched to PhD.
Really? Mm-hmm. They didn't cover tuition for the PhD program?
Oh, they did, but I took out as much money as I possibly could.
Oh, okay.
Because I am a loose cannon. No, but seriously, like every semester, because I mean, I didn't have any help from my parents. The PhD program did not pay much money at all. So like, and I had a house, like I bought a house in Melbourne. I had it for 6 years. Oh. I wish I would still have it because it's worth more than it was when I sold it, but it is fine. So I had a house there in Melbourne. So like everything I paid for and food and all that stuff, and I did a little traveling. Okay. But when the government said, hey, you want this much money? I said, I sure do. And they said, you want all of it? I said, yeah, I do. And then I did that for years.
I want to interject because it's funny because this is when I knew you. When I don't even know if you remember, Aaron, but the way I was introduced to you is because you were my sophomore year organic chemistry teaching assistant. That is when I met you.
What I would have been Gen Chem teaching assistant.
It might have been Gen Chem. Maybe my memory.
I don't think I taught organic lab at FIT. Go ahead.
Sorry, it must have been Gen Chem then. My memory's getting fuzzy.
I believe it was Gen Chem. I don't think I taught organic.
So then it would have been either late 2009 or early 2010, which is, again, right around this time period. So,
right in my wheelhouse, yeah.
Yes, I remember you being a very entertaining teaching assistant, by the way.
Why, thank you.
Yes. If I may, one conversation that I actually, you know how from your past, we've been alive for, James and I, almost 30 years now. Aaron, you longer.
I'm 37 years old. My birthday is in July of 1983.
Well, there you go.
July, you know, 14th. Exact. July 14th.
July is a great month.
Isn't it, though?
You know how some conversations from your past just stick with you and it's unclear why?
Yes. One
conversation that stuck with me my whole life, and finally I can ask you about it. I remember just we were sitting there in lab and I was trying to just synthesize my experiment, which you taught me how to do, Aaron. And then you start going on this rant about how much you don't like Christmas music. And I'm trying to just mix my chemicals. And you're telling me about how you think everyone's been deceived. Christmas music is awful. And I remember exactly what you said. Somebody said, what are you talking about? What about like with this song? And you were like, no. I mean like Jingle Bell Rock. That song is terrible. And I had this picture. Have you moved on and have you accepted Christmas music into your life? Or is that still the way you think?
Jingle Bell Rock is measurably terrible.
All right, no change.
Measurably.
Yes. There are some Christmas songs I like. I love, probably my favorite, if anybody wants to look it up, probably my favorite version of any Christmas song is Hillsong's version of Hark. Hark the Herald Angels Sing, that song.
I will look that up.
Yes, so Hillsong, I think it's Hillsong Worship, does a version of Hark. That is fantastic. And that would probably be my favorite Christmas song. But I like those types of Christmas songs. Here Comes Santa Claus. You know, my wife always says, I'm not lukewarm about things, right? So it's like there's different emotions that you can express, right? Some are you might be better at expressing than others. I'm really great at expressing disgust.
I wonder how you feel about my first Christmas song every year, which I'll come to in about a week, is Rusty Chevrolet by the Oopers.
I don't know that. But I mean, that you spent some time in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, that makes sense.
I actually learned it in Maine. They used to play it on the radio, the classic rock radio station, grew up in Maine.
We'll put it on the show notes for interested listeners.
It's to the tune of Jingle Bells, but a guy sings about his old rusted Chevrolet.
That's fantastic. Like,
it's wonderful.
I think it's good.
Okay, what? Bruce Springsteen, Santa Claus is coming to town. Give me something. Give me anything.
That's a good one.
Ugh.
Terrible.
All right, let's move on. We can't take it anymore.
I love Christmas, though.
I love Christmas, too.
Just not certain Christmas songs.
No, I don't.
Christmas season for me starts December 26th every year and goes until the 25th. Anyway, Aaron, you were giving us I feel like we're just sitting, taking a seat and hearing this wonderful story. So continue.
So, essentially the PhD happened, right? Went through the PhD and didn't really know what I wanted to do. Like, I thought, well, I want to kind of do something that uses my personality, that I can do that. And then I was living in Melbourne at the time, and I was kind of on can dive into the story of, like, so I met my wife while I was in grad school, right? And we met in New York City on an airplane, and we were sitting beside each other. I was actually coming back from Spain from a chemistry conference, which was a rager, and it was wild.
Which airport did you meet her in? I'm from New York, by the way.
JFK.
JFK
on the runway on a Delta flight.
Wow.
It was on a Thursday evening, September 13th, 2012. So it's been almost 8 years since we met. And then obviously we got married 5 years ago yesterday.
Congratulations. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. So she had expressed interest in moving to LA, and we were sort of broken up at the time when I was finishing grad school. Like, I worked at a small company, a startup called Geno in Cocoa, doing some chemistry stuff, whatever. It was fine. So I worked there as like a short-term contract. I was there for 6 months. And then as that was ending, it's funny, it was ending, I went in and talked to the president. And I was like, hey, it's great working for you. And he's like, you're leaving? And I'm like, what is the communication at this place? How did you not know this? Well, anyway, it's neither here nor there. So I had decided I was going to leave. I was going to go to LA. And I thought, well, if I go ahead and go there, even though we're broke up, we'll figure it out. And then I'll already be there, right? This is in my mind, right? So we get, I moved to LA. And I live with my uncle for 14 months. And lived with him in Rancho Palos Verdes, which is in South LA. He bought his house in like the 60s, right? So he's just been there forever. He's 83. And I lived with him for 14 months. And essentially a few months after I got here, my wife and I were talking about something or other. And then she was upset and didn't want to talk to me anymore. And she's like, don't talk to me anymore. And then we had, and then she was actually in Moldova at the time, doing a mission trip. And I knew that she was connecting in Vienna in Austria on the way back. So I bought a flight to Vienna and met her in Vienna and said, hey, don't get on your plane. Like, I'll be waiting for you in Vienna. And then we got back together in Vienna and then got engaged a few months later. Anyway, so that's kind of what happened, right? It's a crazy story. And we plan to write a book about it someday because it's wild. So anyway,
you went and got her back, Aaron.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
In Vienna.
In Vienna. Yeah, in Austria, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not right around the corner.
It's not, no. It's the world. I flew Lufthansa over there. I remember that. It was my only Lufthansa experience, I believe.
Oh, I've been on them once, and that was a nice flight.
Yeah, it's
nice.
German, right? It is German, yes. Mm-hmm. Deutsch. So it's, Deutsch is the German language, not the German, whatever, it doesn't matter. So end up in LA. And when I first got to LA, I couldn't get I didn't have a job with my PhD yet. I applied to 200 places. It's crazy, right? So I was working with a PhD at the Melting Pot, which is a fondue restaurant.
I haven't been there yet, but those are pretty big in the LA area. They like them around here.
Yeah, there were two that actually closed down. I worked at one in Torrance and I worked at one in Pasadena.
Oh, right on. Okay.
So I worked at the Melting Pot for 8 months between both of those. And I was also driving for Uber and for Lyft. And then about 5 months after I got here, I got the teaching job at UCLA, which I had for 3 years. And then I was also working at a company called Staffworks, which staffed major parties in LA. So I did the post, like the post Oscars party and the post Golden Globes party. Tons of celebs, crazy, right? So I was actually at 5 jobs at one time while I was kind of trying to figure everything out. And then I ended up, I think it was April or something like that, where I got contacted by this company called Traceability. They're a startup. I worked with them, great people. I worked with them for 6 months. And then they were going in a different direction. And then they were in an incubator, which is a facility that holds startups. And then from there, I worked, I actually never, didn't even change parking spots. Like stopped working there on a Friday and started working again on a Monday at the, another company in the same building called Sophie Biosciences. I worked for them for 1.5 years. So they do nuclear medicine. They make instruments for nuclear medicine synthesis, like radio synthesis, that you put in like a hot block or a hot, not hot block, excuse me, a, what's it called? The big lead lined, whatever, the thing that my brain is melted, but it's fine. So something that protects you from radiation, essentially. So I worked for them for 1.5 years. And then they were going in a different direction. So they laid me off. So I got laid off. I've been laid off a couple of times. It's not a big deal. So, and then got, I mean, it was kind of crappy at the time, you know, funny story. So when I got laid off the second time, they had told me like, hey, you should talk to this guy. When I got laid off from Sophie, they said, hey, you should talk to this guy at UCLA. You know, he was asking if they knew anyone like me that he could hire. And I was like, hey, well, better than that, there's me, right? But I didn't know that yet. So I remember I left, I got to work and they said, hey, like, just want to let you know your position has been eliminated effective immediately. Goodbye.
That's fun.
Yeah. So I left like that morning, they walked me outside and I called my wife. She was going to the gym and I called my wife and I was like, hey, I don't have a job anymore. She's like, oh, okay, I'll turn around. And I said, and then essentially what we did is I went home, got her. We went, bought 2 bottles of champagne and orange juice and celebrated my next job that I didn't know what it was yet.
Wow.
Because I said, I don't know what my next job is and I don't have one right now, but we're celebrating whatever it's going to be.
That's bold.
Yeah. And then I got the, that was going to be it. That was probably in April of 16, I guess it was. Because we had a trip to New Zealand scheduled. So like I started at UCLA, like after that, I think it was like a month break or something like that, because Sophie had paid me out for a while. And then I started UCLA, was at UCLA for 1 year. As now, remember, this whole time I'd been at UCLA for 2 prior years teaching, but that was a part-time class. I taught on Saturday mornings. So then I was at UCLA for,
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
So for the, like, what does it mean? Maybe this is just like a figure of speech, but like when these companies went in a different direction, like air quotes.
Sure.
Was it a different direction that you disagreed with or a different direction where they didn't need you anymore?
Direction where they did not need me anymore.
Interesting. Yes. So, okay. Another curiosity, like these small companies that you work with, did any of them like make it big by startup standards? Like,
so
like what happened?
Gino, the first one, when I worked for them, they had 30 employees. And as of a couple of years ago, I believe they had 90. So I think they were doing pretty well. Traceability, I believe, has hired some more people since then. And Sophie has basically small fish, large fish, purchased a larger company. So they purchased a series of radio pharmacies. I think they've been doing pretty well in an acquisition. But granted, what I was doing, but they got rid of some of their research team, right? Because they're doing a little different stuff now. So that's the tricky part of working for a startup is because they often are figuring it out, right? They don't know exactly what they're doing from day one. You know, they got a pretty good idea, but maybe they go down one way and say, it makes a little more sense if we go this direction. And then they're like, well, we don't need these people anymore. Which again, I'm not mad at them for that. You know, that's they got to do what they got to do, right?
That's business.
Yeah. You know? So, yeah. So I was at UCLA in their cyclotron facility, which is the particle accelerator that makes, you know, radioactive stuff that you can use for synthesis, which you can use for cancer imaging. And I did development there and I could have stayed there forever. They would have had me forever. Right. Great the healthcare, mammalian vacation days, chill job, like super chill. I was bored, but you know, it was cool. And then I'd been trying to get into sales probably for like the last 6 months I was there. And then I finally got an opportunity to work for a company called Milestone and work for them. Great people. But that moved me up to Seattle. And then I was, you know, recruited by Anton Parr, which is who I'm with now, which I love. And just, you know, better offerings, you know, all the way across the board. So I said, yeah, sure. And I've been with them ever since, which has been great. I mean, I've had two trainings in Austria. I've had had a meeting there in February. So I've been to Austria three times since I started with them a little over 2 years ago.
Nice.
Yeah. And I've been to Austria two other times. I've actually been to Austria five times. The first time was when I went and got back together with my wife.
Okay. Another follow-up question that some people might not be too super aware of, but for you, Aaron, there was a time, I don't know how this ever turned out, but there was a time when you were reading a chapter of the Bible every day and writing about it.
That's correct.
You, that's a different story for a different day, but I remember sure. You started every writing with, where you were at that moment.
Yep.
I did. It was like every place I could ever imagine. And it never seemed like you were in one place for more than like 2 days.
That's probably pretty true.
Was that like personal travel or business travel at the time? Like,
both.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are you just always on the move?
Not so much this year, which sucks, yep. But generally I believe that sort of for me, I want to see as much of the world as I can. And I feel like it's part of my purpose to experience other people, the best that I can do. But yes, no, the Bible blog is on a pause. So I paused that at the beginning of last year. It's pretty dense. If you've ever read it, it's very dense. And if you're reading it straight through, some of it is pretty, it's like walking through, you know, mud. Because
I think I made it halfway through Exodus with you. Like I stuck with you for a little while.
Hey, no, that's great. Yeah, no, I paused in Psalms. And if you read like for like Proverbs, right? People like love Proverbs, right? I mean, if you read Proverbs one water after the other, you're like, man, this is the same stuff.
It gets a little repetitive.
So yeah. Now I know some people feel all different ways about the Bible. So whatever, but I read it, you know, I'm reading it to, you know, just pick it like I was picking it up for the first time and saying, hey, what is this? You know, what's everybody talking about? So that's been the journey for that. But yeah, that is on pause. I paused that at the beginning of the year because my brain needed a break. I actually was learning German extensively too. And my brain needed a break for that too.
So I have a question.
Yes, James.
Based on the long story we got.
Yes.
Which was good.
Thanks.
So what piece of advice would you give to a young person who's interested in doing what you're doing?
Oh, I'm so excited because I have no idea what's going to come.
To do sales?
I don't know. Chemistry, sales, whatever. I don't know.
It could be anything. Like what someone's, there's a young person here. Young. We're younger than you, Aaron. What advice would you give?
Or you know, somebody 20 years younger than you. What would you have told yourself 20 years younger?
So I talk to my cousin a lot, and he's 23. And something I kind of constantly tell him is, you know, if you don't want to go to college, don't go to college. Don't waste your money. Like, it's a massive waste of money. There are so many other ways to make plenty of money, and you don't need to go to college to do that. Like, if you want to be a scientist or a teacher or a therapist or a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer, then yeah, go to college. But if you want to do anything else, don't go to college. Like, it doesn't make any sense at all unless you want the college experience. Sure, right? You can pay $30,000 to go to a bunch of parties if you want to, whatever. Or you can find some friends and go to parties for free. I don't know. But it's, yeah, I mean, I would say, like, I wouldn't want to take anyone's experience of anything away from them. So, like, if somebody's like, hey, I really want to go to college, go to college. If you don't want to, don't, right? If you want to be a scientist, great. If you want to be a painter, perfect, right? I think my biggest advice to people would be never to discourage them from what they want to do. And they know on some level what is important to them and what they want to do. Or, and if you don't, if you're lost, that's great too. To just throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks.
And you know, this is an interesting conversation because I've actually in the last like 5 years kind of flip-flopped a few times on this topic. There have been times when I had exactly your thought of like college is unnecessary for a lot of people. And I do think a lot of people probably shouldn't go to college because it winds up just being a financial burden. They don't get any.
Like, sure. Money. Yeah. And then what are you going to pay for it with? Somebody right. With a, you know.
But then I also think of someone like you where like you, I don't know, you were young and kind of like you said, you went to a bad high school and seemed like you didn't have too much of a purpose. But college gave you a purpose because one thing led to another and then you were able to have a career out of it.
You know, that's a really good point. Oh, well, let's put it this way. I would only deter someone from college if they were adamant that they didn't want to go or if they wanted to do something that didn't require it. But if you're lost and you don't really know where you're going, it's probably not a bad idea. Does that make sense?
Because I feel like I always have this phrase. I feel like most students who go to college go because it's the thing to do. High school ends. What do? You go to college. Yeah. It's just what you do.
Yeah.
And I've just flip-flopped on. I'm inconsistent in my own mind whether or not that's a good idea.
Well, I would say this. And if you really want to go to college, like go to, you know, Oxford, Cambridge or something like that. Don't go in America where it is $1 million, right? Hmm. That could be an idea too. Go to college in New Zealand or in Australia or something like that. That's going to be 1,000 times less.
And you get to go to a different country.
Yeah, life experience.
Yeah, I think the life experience, really getting outside of what you grew up in, that is what's going to build you. Like, it's both. Like, let's say instead of going to college, I lived in London and worked in a bar or whatever, right? I also would have grown culturally because I got out of what I was in and placed in something else. So I think there's maybe a couple different ways of looking at it. I don't know if it's just college that does that. I mean, sure, it helps. And it's helpful to go through those exercises of making your mind think in ways that you wouldn't normally do that. That's obviously helpful. But on some level, that does require a little bit of effort on your part.
Since I know we have a hard cutoff, there's at least two questions in my mind. James will probably think of three or four that I want to get out.
And if you need to do a part 2, 3, 4, 7 with me, that's fine too. You just let me know.
We can make this a partnership. one question that we do always like to ask is like, again, given this huge experience that you've had and your whole life, we often like to ask, what are you excited about the future? Not necessarily like for you personally, but just like for the world, for technology. And then similarly, what are you concerned about with the future?
Great question. I think I'm excited. I'm excited about this vaccine. That's for sure.
Yes. I think we all are.
I'm excited about the awareness of people. People are slowly becoming more aware. We're becoming more human. We're becoming more compassionate as humans overall, as we are forcibly exposed to the stories of others. I think that's very exciting. I think, I would be concerned. I don't know if I live in a world of concern because I believe the future is full of hope.
So you just choose not to be concerned.
Perhaps. Maybe that's a bit rose-colored, and that's fine. But if I lean towards concerned, like, oh, what am I concerned about? Then I swing back into hope. And like, there's so much to be hopeful for. And I mean, like, I even look at, you know, a generation like my nieces, right, who are 12 and 11, like a generation where they will grow up, you know, in such a world that has been so much more accepting of a lot of different types of ideas and perspectives that, you know, we may not have. Was that a non-answer? Hopefully that was not too much of a non-answer. Yeah, I think
that's fair.
Let's put it this way. I think one thing that's concerning is the mechanization of everything. I do think it will be concerning when we get to a point where we have more people than we have jobs. And will we get to a point where we have, and that's, I don't have to be hopeless to think that. Like, that seems inevitable. Like one thing, like truck drivers, for example. Like, we will get to a point where truck drivers don't have jobs because all trucks will be mechanized. And if you're FedEx, right, do you want the robot truck or you want the human truck? You want the robot truck because the robot truck doesn't have health insurance.
See, this is why we need to keep probing, because we went from no concerns at all to robots are going to take over the world.
Well, not take over the world, but it will take some jobs.
It will take some jobs.
Yeah,
right.
They will take jobs.
Yeah, that is definitely...
We'll take that type of concern. I'm more comfortable with that, for sure.
Okay.
Yeah. James, this is where you often think of the big questions that we missed. But
go for it, John.
Oh, Aaron. This was all just warm-up. This was training for the most important question. I don't know if you read the preview of the questions we were going to ask, so you might not know this is coming.
I did. I skimmed through it, but I don't remember what you're going to say.
What is your favorite pizza topping? Gosh.
Probably.
I'm sorry. Of all the questions we asked, that was like the most like hard I've saw you.
Yeah. I would say it's, you know, to be honest with you, it's probably those, you know, in high school when you had the pizzas and they had the little tiny square cube pepperonis.
No.
Really?
Might be those.
Okay. Yeah.
Cube? It's probably pepperoni, honestly. Even though pepperoni is like not even meat. Oh. What is that? What is that? Pig? What? What is that? It's trash.
Like,
I'm sure.
Like the really small cubes, right? Like two.
Yeah, yeah, those little things. Yeah.
Oh, they put those on bagel bites.
Yeah. Oh, they do those. Yep, those are great.
Yeah,
yeah, they're great. Really? I mean, they're empirically disgusting.
So why don't we just take one last question? We like to give an opportunity, Aaron. This was great. If any of our listeners want to follow you, reach out to you, anything like that, anywhere that they can follow you that you can point them to.
Yeah, so if you want to follow my life's journey, that's going to be on Instagram at call me the Dr. Funk. And that's going to be DR like doctor.
All right, then. Very good. I think I'm a follower of you, too.
So. You, I believe you do, yeah.
So yeah.
Call me the Dr. Funk on Instagram. And if you decide to do that, please let me know that you heard me on this podcast. Yes. And then I have a podcast that is beginning. I don't think I know the name yet, but we're pretty sure we're going to call it The Opaque Take.
The Opaque Take. Yeah, very good. Well, for all of our listeners, we'll definitely look out for that. And once that gets launched, we'll let our listeners know as well, just so that they can hear more of your voice if they so desire.
I'm sure they will.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Aaron. This was really fantastic. And thank you for being our first chemist on the show.
Absolutely happy to be here. It's not just sound of chemistry, or maybe it is human chemistry. I'm not sure. But yeah, let me know if you want to ask me some more questions.